Those hardy souls. Okay, we've got two to cover off. We've got, first we're going to have the ACC giving us an update, New Zealand, and then Northern Territory we're going to have Leslie talk about Northern Territory CTP. So firstly, the ACC update is going to be given by Jonathan Nichols and Sandra Chapman. Jonathan's going to start. Jonathan spent 10 years as a consultant with PwC before, mainly based in Wellington, spent a bit of time in Sydney, and has had a whole range of roles, including appointed actuary roles, but he's now joined the ACC in June 2013. So he's a relatively newbie, but he's been doing a whole lot of work with them prior to that. He's going to get up and talk. He's also a member of the New Zealand Society of Actuaries General Insurance Committee, and actually coordinated the GI seminar that was held in Wellington. So, Sandra is Wellingtonian. Is that how I say it? Okay. And has spent most of her career at the ACC. During that time, she's been involved in a number of actuarial initiatives with the introduction of experience rating to workers' comp pricing in 2011, a highlight. Sandra's current focus is contributing to the wider ACC business with the actuarial insight and advice, and she's recently been involved with the preparation of a 2013 FCR. Sandra is also a member of the New Zealand Society of Actuaries Education Committee, and was coordinator of Future Pathways sessional meeting presented and aimed at students and younger actuaries. It was held in Auckland and Wellington earlier this year. So I will hand over to Jonathan first, and he's going to get us going, and then I'll introduce Leslie after we've had that talk.
Cool, thanks very much. And thanks to those sitting in the front three rows. That's very impressive. Very much weighted towards the back. Right, so what are we going to cover? It's pretty basic, really. It's a scheme update, but we should start by saying, what does ACC do? What does it cover? One thing, if you've been to a few scheme updates, you'll know by now, although you probably knew before you went to the scheme updates, that each scheme varies considerably as far as how it works. And then just, you know, what's been happening recently, what are the key recent trends, and what is the focus going forward? Because, of course, whatever we focus on going forward is precisely what will happen as per the way these things work. So ACC, what do we do? Well, we're governed by the Accident Compensation Act 2001, so that's almost modern. 400 pages of sheer goodness, but if you don't have time to read it, that's sort of the one-line summary. Comprehensive, no-fault personal injury cover for all New Zealand residents and visitors to New Zealand. So the key point is it is no fault. There's none of this messing around with common law that some of you schemes seem to have. It covers tourists and visitors as well, which is really useful for our tourism sector, which is quite important, and particularly the adventure tourism sector. If you think about bungee jumping, it's nice to know that even if you come from overseas, you're covered by ACC. It does your travel insurance no harm either. Funded by New Zealanders through five accounts. Sorry, just lost it. The word comprehensive, when it comes to ACC, has real meaning compared to the very fragmented approach that we have in Australia. And this is something that came through in Paul O'Connor's address yesterday. We've got five different accounts that together cover everything. That's the so we've got work, you know, which you know you'd relate to workers' compensation over here. You've got motor vehicle, which would obviously relate to CTP. But we've got these three other accounts as well. Earners, so people who are injured not in the workplace, but they are still injured, you know, at home, perhaps doing a bit of DIY and fall off the roof. They're still covered. Non-earners, so, for example, if you're elderly and you have a fall at home, you're still covered. Not weekly compensation, of course, because you're not working anymore, but as far as the various medical costs... Great.
Indeed.
So non-earners covered, and then treatment injury, as far as injuries arising from medical treatment. And the way that works is each of those schemes is different as far as the way it's funded through the levies and the like, as you can see there. But what it basically means is when a claim comes in for an accident, it's an accident. From a claims management perspective, they don't worry about what the different benefits are. It is really quite distracting. The benefits... the benefits don't vary by scheme, right? The benefits are the same for everyone. So someone comes in Yes, we note what account it should be as far as funding, as far as monitoring and future trends, but people are covered the same, whichever bucket they happen to be in. So that's kind of cool, and particularly the non-earners component, I think, is pretty much unique to New Zealand. I haven't contacted every other country to check, but I think that's the case. Which is cool compared to the fragmentation of Australia. Now, what this means, of course, is that we have five different schemes, and as per the scheme updates, 20 minutes per scheme. I will be going for the next 100 minutes, so do let me know if you have a plane to catch. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works, but it'd be cool if it did. So that's what we do. So the next step is, what are the key recent trends? And I'll hand over to Sandra.
Thank you. So we're kind of looking at the scheme overall, which is all of the five accounts, because that's how we manage the financial sustainability of the scheme. So recent trends. So here's this lovely graph from our PwC actuaries who do our valuation. So what you can see from here is this is all accidents for all of the accounts by June accident year. You can see the outstanding liability estimates and the payments to date. And the dotted lines are the valuation estimates for various years. So you can see that leading up to 2009, there was increases happening all the way through. And consequently, those early valuation estimates were saying it's going to continue unless you do something. You can see that top line, that June 2009 estimate, is high. And, so rapidly increasing claim costs and levies, obviously, to fund those, basically undermining the financial viability of the scheme. And the government were obviously concerned about that. Things came in to change that. And basically since then, you can see the drop since 2009, things have reduced to more sustainable levels, and the valuation assumptions and projections have corresponded to that. Now, some of those drops, I guess thinking about what has been the main drivers of those, it's a long-term scheme, obviously. So things like your weekly compensation, which we pay out to age 65, serious injury claims who get lifetime care. There's no lump sum payment to finalise the claim. It goes on until you no longer require support. So focusing on those particular types of claims, our National Serious Injury Service, which was headed by Liz Cairns, she did some fantastic work in bringing about improvements in the way those clients are serviced and making sure that we are paying for outcomes. And obviously we've also been focusing on our long-term weekly compensation claims. And making sure that they're getting what they need and that they're getting the support to get back to work as soon as possible. Yeah, I think that's probably it for that one. Oh, and I guess just a point on that is that because we are a national organisation covering everything, and we do the claims management in-house, operational changes are easier to implement because it goes across the board, and we can do that without having to facilitate a whole lot of different schemes, different providers, that kind of thing. So that recent strong financial performance has definitely helped the financial sustainability of the scheme, and it's actually so. Although we are, we do our levy setting, we provide advice to the board and to the government on levy rates. The ultimate decision on levy rates is the government's, and so they obviously need to have confidence in what we're doing and the advice that we're giving and the sustainability of what we're doing in order to approve levy decreases. And I guess the recent performance has given them the confidence to signal that in the recent levy consultation that we've just done, they have signalled drops in levy rates going forward. So here's our solvency position for each of the five accounts and the ACC scheme in total. Probably one of the interesting things to note is the quite considerable increase between 11-12 and 12-13. And the main reason for that is that government were not ready to drop levy rates in 12-13. And so they did keep those levy rates at the higher levels until they could see the sustainability and the continuation of that progress. So those levy rates, particularly for the work account and the earners account, were set higher than they needed to be to fund those claims costs that we were projecting. So consequently, we've got quite a nice little overfunding in those accounts. The motor vehicle account, so full funding hasn't been the constant way of funding ACC. We have been pay-as-you-go at certain times during the 50-year history, it will be next year, I think. And in particular, claims prior to 1999 are still being funded, still trying to reach the full funding. The target is to be full funded by 2019, particularly in the motor vehicle account where we have a long tail because they're serious injuries, they go on for a long time. We are still getting to that full funding target. And the non-earners account, which is, as Jonathan mentioned, funded by the government, so that's for people who are not working at all at the time of injury. That is funded by the government, and that's got quite a different funding policy. So there's still a large pay-as-you-go funding portion for those claims, and that is set to continue. So key recent trends again in what we're doing with our levies. We're trying to better price for the underlying risk. And one of those things that Andrew mentioned in my bio was the experience rating in the work account, which is still fairly new. It's about 3 years old now. And also, one of the proposals that we have and that we've just done in our levy consultation is to introduce a vehicle safety rating in the motor vehicle account. So the way that will work is that car owners will be paying a different levy rate depending on the safety rating of the cars that they're driving. We're using a mixture of the ANCAP we're using research from Monash University on the safety of the car when it's involved in a crash. So what we're looking at is how anybody involved in that crash caused by that car is affected during that crash, and the safer you are, the more protection you have from that car, the lower your levy rate will be. That's still a proposal, hasn't been accepted by the government yet, but we're confident, hopeful. The other thing we're doing, so within the motor vehicle account, we do price different types of vehicles differently. And this, here's just an example of what we try to do. So for motorcycles, we're trying to price based on claims experience. And what we find with motorcycles is that the costs are a lot higher, because if you're on a motorcycle and you're involved in a crash, your chances of having serious injury are a lot greater. You get a lot more damage. So obviously one of the things that motorcyclists say is that, well, it's not our fault, it's the cars, it's everybody else driving around us who causes those crashes, causes that damage. So you can look at it in two ways. You can look at it, the actual claims experience of a motorcycle when a motorcycle's involved, or you can look at it as the claims experience when it's just that didn't involve any other vehicle. And you can see that even with those estimates of the costs of accidents, we're still not quite collecting the correct levy, but we're trying to go some way to introducing some of that risk in those levy rates. Okay, so that's all the financial stuff, the solvency, the levy rates, and all of this stuff is the actual work that we do, and it's in all our publicly available reports, but they're quite technical. Things like the annual report, the levy setting report, the financial condition report. So what is it that the public see when they look at ACC? And you've probably seen some of this. So we have a lot of media and pressure about who gets compensated, who can claim, and pushing the boundaries of what is actually available when you claim. So these are a couple of headlines that have been in the press. Brain damaged mum wins compo fight. Labour stop filthy fleecing of ACC claimants. And then there's this, which I'm sure you probably heard a little bit about over here, the privacy breach. So this is what the public see, and this is about showing that there's more. It's more than just the financials. We do need to look at ensuring that customers have a clear view of what to expect when they come to ACC, ensuring that we keep all of that data that we have on individuals, which is a lot, ensuring we keep it private and we keep it safe. And so we've done a lot of work. We've still got a long way to go, but we have done a lot of work to try and address some of these issues. And those privacy breaches did cause considerable concern. There was a report, independent privacy report, that had 44 recommendations on what ACC needed to do to help change this culture of not ensuring the privacy of the data that we have. We had a complete change in the board and the executive leadership team. We've had significant operational changes to address some of these things, and we're trying to focus on a customer service level. So of those 44 recommendations, I think we've got about over half of them have been embedded so far, and we're looking to be recognised as a leader in privacy management within the near future, which is a big step for us. There's a lot of work to do around that, but we have a chief privacy officer who's in charge of that, who reports directly to the chief executive, and working on it. So that's what's been happening, and so now Jonathan's going to talk to us about what we're planning to do in the future.
Cool, thanks, Sandra. And I guess the key point to make out of just what we've seen there is the inherent need to balance the outcomes between the financial outcomes and the customer outcomes, what's best for the customer. And that is very much the focus going forward, is to try and balance those two outcomes. So there's a lot of change management currently going through our claims management group with a big project called Client Service Optimisation. Something that Paul O'Connor mentioned in his address yesterday was that one of the responses they often got from customers is the need to only tell your story once. Whereas for a lot of the schemes, and certainly that is the case with our scheme, a customer has to have it, you know, has to navigate the complexity of ACC. And what we're wanting to do is bring in a new customer service model where they only tell their story once and all the complexity can occur behind the scenes. So we've got some consultation groups giving us a lot of insights into what our customers are thinking and what they'd like. And we're bringing in a new client service model as a model, as opposed to just an approach where we've got predictive modelling. So when a claim form comes in, based on the certain characteristics, the injury type and the age and so on and so forth, it identifies client with a high likelihood of needing certain support, and so that support and the potential duration, and therefore there can be proactive contacting of clients to say, okay, you know, vocational rehab is going to be really important here. Let's get on the front foot to try and provide that support as early as we can. And it also means that for the client, they have minimal points of contact with ACC. So ACC navigates the complexity rather than the client. So that's what we're doing on the customer service side. And actually, there's a couple of other things there. I will just mention this because it came up with the NDIS. We have a pilot currently going, which is about to be rolled out, I believe, around seriously injured clients who can do a self-assessment online, work out their needs and contract their services that they need based on the funding offered, which is very similar to what NDIS is doing. So that's kind of cool. There's a couple of other initiatives, one around employers as well, with, again, part of navigating this complexity. If we have one case manager on site who deals with all the issues with ACC, be it case management, be it workplace safety programs and that sort of thing, so that the employer doesn't have to navigate a whole lot of different points of contact. So that's just to make the customer experience easier and simpler. So that's the customer side. On the financial side, and this is the last slide, Mr. Chairman, aiming to increase our long-term financial sustainability. As at June 13, the June 13 financial year, we had a $4.9 billion surplus, which was nice, came from investments and discount rates and improved rehabilitation rates, so that's still pretty good. We are obviously still slightly in deficit, but the trend line, as we saw from Sandra's slides, is very good indeed. So our future direction is about ensuring that sustainability while ensuring that we don't compromise customer service. And then, of course, just lastly, as far as financial sustainability, it's been interesting to see some of the themes that we're seeing coming through with a lot of the schemes here. Long-term issues like ageing and comorbidities, which has both the financial impact but also, of course, the making sure you've got the capability and the capacity to meet those needs, and also, of course, medical inflation. And we have various initiatives in place that we're not really ready to talk about, but things like contracting for outcomes, which we're starting to look to do to try and get that under control. So that's our focus going forward, and in 2 years' time we'll be able to report how all of that's been very successful. That's us.
Okay, thanks Sandra and Jonathan. I'm just going to quickly introduce Leslie. Leslie, I think many of you will know, Leslie has worked in personal injury roles since 1996 in Queensland and the Northern Territory. Her current position is as Senior Manager, Portfolio and Regulatory Affairs with the TIO in Darwin. In this role, she assesses the financial viability and development of the MAC portfolio and TIO's workers' compensation portfolio. This includes assessment of claims management and overall scheme performance and design, commentary on financial results, and liaison with the appointed actuary. Leslie recently contributed to the MAC scheme review in the Northern Territory with a specific focus on implementing the national NIIS benchmarks into the Northern Territory scheme. So I'll hand it over to Leslie.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming to the penultimate session. I'll just mention briefly workers' compensation because you'd be aware that it's a private sector underwritten scheme in the Territory, and TIO's got about a 20% share. The NT WorkSafe is the regulator, and I haven't seen anyone from NT WorkSafe at this seminar. So I will say that if you want to find out whether or not there's a review going on the scheme, you better look on the website because there is. It's starting reasonably slowly, I think, probably brought about by the fact that we had a change of government, and there's maybe a little bit more appetite to bring a bit more balance back towards the employer rather than the employee. But the scheme's not actually broken, terribly broken. There's a process at the moment that might end up being fast or it might end up being slow, depending on the politician's appetite. So I need to work out how to change this, don't I? No, I did. Okay, the introductory slide. It's probably, I'd say my talk is a little bit themed rather than a pure update. So let's just focus on claim frequency. I suspect that's probably reasonably representative of CTP schemes around Australia. That blue arrow is important, and you'll find out why on the last slide. The endpoints, just in case you can't read the scale, 2.4 claims per 1,000 registered vehicles for the no-fault part and 0.15 for common law. So my talk firstly is about what we call MACNIS, which is the Motor Accident Compensation National Injury Insurance Scheme for the Territory, and therefore it's about large claims. So this chart is about a year old, and also this shows my lack of graphing skills, because that orange line, which is the denotes the reforms, which is when we effectively cut common law out for the non-residents. We'd cut it out for the residents ages ago, and so the only common law schemes, common law claims we have now are from interstate accidents. That orange line should be one over. Could I do it on the chart? Nope. We've had 5 full years with the reforms since we removed common law from non-residents. Victoria's being nice to us. The cost of two of the claims in the last year, you can see there's 4 claims there, so it's a number of claims. 2 of those have been met by TAC, some Chinese students injured around Alice Springs. I bet it was a high car. And our reinsurance deductible is currently $3.5 million. So now we have the cost of large no-fault claims. So these are done, we do our current claims cost, and then every 6 months we do the inflation for the average weekly earnings and the tenant care rates, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, claims cost before ongoing inflation is around $3 million. And seems to be reasonably stable at that. You'll note that the large claim in 2007 one's $5.5 million. You think, oh, why? All I'll say is that there was only one claim, 2006, 2007, so therefore there's no benefit of averaging across across the portfolio. The real question, how will our claim size increase with MacNIS? So those of you who are familiar with our scheme will know that we are pretty close to the NIST minimum benchmarks except for attendant care. And on that, we have a cap on the number of hours, 32 hours per week, and we have a set rate, which is 2% of average weekly earnings, which at the moment is $28.17 per hour. Now, if you're seriously injured, that is not going to go too far. In the second wave of launch sites for NDIS, the territories got to have one around the Barkly region, Town Tennant Creek, and they think there'll be, I think it's about 100 NDIS people that they expect to start looking after from 1 July 2014. And we don't have to go national, or sorry, we don't have to go territory wide on 1 July 14, but we are meant to go at least for that tiny section. So in good public policy terms, we're hoping to convince the government to go territory wide on the 1st of July 14, just to make it a little easier, and also because we've been waiting for a long time to do something better for our attendant care claimants. Now, because we're already a no-fault scheme, we don't have to do all those things like South Australia's doing and New South Wales had to do 7 years ago, etc., which is to set up new authorities. So all we need to do is put a new subsection in the current MAC Act, and we'll call it MacNIS. Well, we won't, but that'll be effectively what it is. And then the last point is one of the key ones that's exercising our minds and morals, whatever, at the moment. NIS is not required to apply retrospectively. But the NTMAC might be able to apply some retrospectivity for existing catastrophic injuries if the scheme's being deemed to be able to afford it. We don't know yet. And then just run through a little shopping list here. Those of you who are involved in implementing a NIS in some form or another, market reference hourly rate for attendant care. We've got to have a stock take of attendant care staff resources and infrastructure in urban, rural and remote NT. We've got to upskill staff. Provider networks and relationships, consumer education, and get some guidelines ready for 1 July 14. And the key guidelines might include reasonable and necessary decision making, standard of care, family members, respite, and participants living overseas. My first comment is that whole little list I think you've probably heard quite a few times already in the last day and three quarters. The second thing that I'd say is when I was working on this, I decided I need to talk to Andrew Fronsko when I get back because I've got participants living overseas and I'm thinking, wait a minute. And under the MAC scheme, we let them commute benefits up to certain limits now, which that gets you just the indication that there's lots to consider in implementing this, even in our fairly simple requirements, and the devil's in the detail. And I didn't want to put the costing assumptions up on a slide in case someone took it away, so I'm just going to tell you. So 2.3 claims to enter MacNIS each year. The territory's got 250,000 people living there, plus a few tourists. At the moment, for the attendant care rate, we've priced it on $40 and $50, and the attendant care hours we think will be something like 60 to 70 hours a week. Volatility, of course, will be. So now we're going to move off, Nick. We're going to move NIS. We're going to move to this, which I think is kind of interesting because I'm interested in how many other schemes are starting to think about this. I talked to a Victorian who said, oh, yeah, I suppose we'll end up doing it. So this is the incremental increases in the age pension eligibility, and I won't go through the framework, but if you were born after 1 July 57, which is probably quite a few people in this room, sorry, you're going to have to wait until 67 years old, quote, for the age pension. That is, if you haven't got good enough superannuation. The public expectation would be that compensation schemes would move up to fill in the gap. Do they have to? The NTA government has already changed the legislation for workers' comp, and so then we actually did the revaluation. We had took a bit of a hit on the provisions, and then the premiums marginally increased. Changes to the MAC Act are included in the current package of amendments, just to give you an idea. In our small scheme, the impact on outstanding claims liabilities for the MAC scheme is $4.7 million in an overall valuation of about $280 million, which is 1.6%, and the ongoing premium impact is about $1 a year, and I'm not sure how many other CTP schemes have already proposed the legislation change to meet that public expectation, and they better hurry up because they've only got until 1 July 17. So another, this is that, to me, this unregistered, unregisterables, etc., is but the thin end of the wedge, I'd have to say. In the 2007 reforms, I think MAC, like Northern Territory, arguably went too far by letting in private property accidents. This gave rise to claims for injuries on unregisterable and non-compliant vehicles such as motocross bikes and quad bikes, and you'd have some of those large claims I showed you at the start, and a disproportionate number of those are in that, like pleasure-seeking, risk-taking, etc. behaviour. Why should the motorists of the Territory pay for that? The good behaviour ones. So it's possible that we did extend the boundary too far for a CTP scheme by bringing that in for public in the private property. Coming from the other direction, though, because beware, there's quite a lot of alternate types of vehicles and mobility devices are getting more and more common and pushing the boundaries. Apparently, under the auspices of Austroads, which I guess stands for Australian Roads, I don't know, there's a project going on right now to look at those all types of alternate vehicles to workshop what's good public policy from a registration perspective. Because on the one hand, you might think it'd be good to have them registered so you could actually do some safety stuff with them. But on the other hand, do we want them in our CTP scenes? In the current NT reform package, we are considering all benefits to owners and drivers of unregistered and unregisterable vehicles, unless their conditional registration has been allowed on both public and private property. A 3-month grace period will be allowed for registered vehicles. That's in Cabinet about now. Whether it gets through will be kind of interesting. Two issues. One is that puts us below the NIST minimum benchmarks for the unregistered vehicles on public property, because you're supposed to have them. It's okay if you don't have them on private property. And particular issue for the remote Indigenous communities. And we, of course, as you would expect, that for the insurer, we would have an awareness campaign to say, make sure your vehicle's registered. Is that going to reach those people? So back to the other side, if it does happen that a NIST category injury happens in the circumstances of unregistered vehicles on public property, the NDIS, as you've heard, will provide benefits, but they'll seek recovery from the NT government. Now, we're going to talk about segways. Love it. The name Segway, PT, means smooth transition personal transporter. To me, it means smooth transition to falling over and hitting your head. But anyway, on a sad note, I can add that in 2010, the new owner of Segway Company, an English Northern English industrialist, died in a fall down a cliff on his Segway. So it got reported as inventor of Segway. I can report that the actual inventor of Segway, Dean Carman, is alive and well and living in New Hampshire, but it's still, well, tricky. There's a tourism push in various jurisdictions to approve Segways for use in tourist locations, for instance, in Lakeside in Canberra. The NT government has been approached for permission to use in East Point, around the waterfront tourist locations, and because it's over 200 watts, our legislation right this minute, we're going to have to conditionally register it and take a CTP premium on it, and I think that is just... It is so far from being a motor vehicle. Well, you can see what they're like. And now, Queensland, where we are right now, the use of Segway became legal on the 1st of August 2013, and Queensland's Transport Minister noted that it makes sense for Segways to be allowed on public paths across Queensland given that users wear helmets. Too bad about the pedestrians they knock over. This is my small stray into road safety topics. INPEX, big thing in Darwin, LNG development, etc. They did their homework pretty good. I guess it was part of getting the approval of the government and that. They decided that they would go into a road safety campaign about trucks. And so there's some examples of the awareness that they did. And some people would say that good on them for doing, and other people might say, INPEX is only doing what it should be, given they're putting a lot of trucks onto small roads in the Territory. But at least they did something. They were quite neat ads, actually. So we're nearly finished. So we commenced premium indexation 1 July 2011. It's indexed by CTP, although our CPI. Of course, the green line is what you index your benefits by. And that's the green line's average weekly earnings, volatile over the decade, but strong of late due to INPEX, etc. But I don't know what happened to the series in 2012. Small jurisdiction. CPI is not ideal for inflating compensation schemes, but it's more palatable for governments. They want to do it because it's more consistent with the other indexed household expenses. So at the moment, that's what we have. In the legislation, it has a competent person review needs to be held every 3 years. So it's just 3 years since we had indexation, so it's going to be conducted in the lead up to the 2014 premium. They're the sorts of things we wanted to look at. As you can imagine, the competent person is likely to be an actuary. In fact, the NT-Treasury has chosen the person, and work starts now. Last slide. So I talked about whether or not we can possibly afford to give some retrospective benefits to our seriously injured persons. You'll then notice there the green arrow, which is in 2008-09. Our indexation for 1 July 11 was based on frequency assumptions before the 09-10 drop in frequency was recognised. That is, it's on the green arrow assumption. We have been banking some money for a few years, so we may be able to afford some retrospective improvement in attendant care benefits, and I'll say just sometimes. The long-tail nature of the scheme and the delay in identifying a trend can lead to a balance of incomes rather than a bit of a disaster. Finished.
Thank you. Now, I do believe we have about 2 minutes, if anyone would like to ask any particular questions.
Do you want to know where you can buy a Segway?
Oh, we've got one question. I suppose you should, yeah.
Probably for you. Might be for me.
Hi. Just a quick question. Am I reading you correctly that the launch sites for the NWIS, is that currently covering unregistered and unregisterable vehicles for the purpose of catastrophic injury?
The NDIS just does the commutative price, things like that.
Yeah.
When the NIIS comes in to bring in on that very same day, then it will only cover unregistered on the public roads.
Okay. Any more questions? If not, I think we're done. Do we thank once again our presenters?